And I'm Reggie.
And this is a newer version of R&B Talks.
It is indeed.
It is indeed.
It is indeed.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our new format.
Well, it's not format. Like, it's still a long form.
It's still a long form podcast.
Long form two guys to think they're...
Reggie just ate turkey. Yeah. It's okay.
I know.
The tryptophan is kicking in.
We had Friendsgiving.
Yeah, we had Friendsgiving. It was good. It's delicious. Guys, kind of goes along with what we're talking about today. Well, you know, it's this whole community thing, right? Reggie, how was your holiday? Was it a festive holiday? It was full of festivities?
You know, I don't think I've eaten this much in a long time. Like, even counting holidays and year, like, there was, so we had basically three Thanksgiving dinners.
Yeah.
Counting the one we just had, right?
That's not cool.
Oh, you know, well, it's, look, I love food. Don't get me wrong. But, like, you know, it's like, I woke up on Friday, right? And I'm like, oh, but I was, my stomach was growling.
Yeah.
But I like didn't want to eat at all.
Yeah.
But really, you still got to eat.
Still got to have something.
You still got to have something, you know? So, yeah, but, you know, it's good, but I think it's apropos to have a discussion about community around the Thanksgiving holiday.
Yeah. This has been a real bugger for me for a while. I've really, you know, I know, and I don't want to talk about and get into politics, but part of this past political season that we went through, it really started to highlight the difference between tribalism and community, because there's a definitive difference, right? You know, some discussions I've had with some people and, you know, listening to my wife and my children talk and the experiences that they're having as I listen to them. And there's just really a desperate need, I think, for us to define not spiritual community. We've talked about that, but what is a community and how do we bolster a community and how do we tell the difference between someone who's trying to get us to engage in tribalism versus engaging in community, right? An example I will use is, and I don't use this example to get down this road. I just use it as an example is LGBTQ. I don't think that's a community. I think that's a tribe. Tribes are short lived. They can be dangerous. They can do a lot of damage in a short period of time. They're not really welcoming and accepting of everyone. Most communities are welcoming and accepting of everyone as long as no one's attempting to hurt or damage the community. And unfortunately, you know, I think that along with that, I think BLM was a tribe, Antifa was a tribe. You know, I think that there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of tribalism amongst churches, like not community tribalism, right? Like you have to really look at what tribalism means. It's very short-lived. I actually have some information here that's very, very powerful about tribalism, and it's very kind of cut to the bone. But, you know, one of the differences, tribalism is driven by emotion. Community is driven almost biologically. We weren't built to be alone, right? And whether that means a marriage and a family, your family and my family has melded as a community. We support and love each other and take care of each other. And we do that well knowing that we're not always going to agree, that we're not always going to see eye to eye, but that's okay, because at the core of what we're doing, we're heading in the same direction. I believe that tribalism is based solely on out of control emotion a lot of times.
Okay.
I want to carve off something for myself because I feel left out. But a lot of times that's because you want to identify as something that's so uniquely one-sided that you really can't build a community on it, right? I mean, community is all about diversity of people helping each other. Like you had said before, if you see your neighbor out there struggling, you're going to go help your neighbor. if I look across the street and I see my neighbor needs some help, I'm going to go over there and help my neighbor. I don't know another way to define it better than, you know, community is almost, it's almost built into us, spiritually, emotionally, mentally, physically. But now that I've talked a lot, Reggie, what do you think?
Yes.
And that was R&B Talks today. Thank you. No, just, you're going to have to bring the hammer, bro. Come on. You're usually the most loquacious individual I know. And I got yes. So what do you think? Tell me what you think tribalism is, Reggie.
It's not tribalism that I was focused on. Matter of fact, so if you look at community from a biblical perspective, you really got to start at the very creation of humanity. Mm-hmm. So the community started with just a man and a woman. And you could argue that's not really community, but you know, that's where the everything starts from this point, where you have a covenant relationship between a man and a woman, and they are to procreate and then, subdue the earth as they were expelled from the garden because they were idiots and couldn't control themselves. So the early reaching out from there, we see like in the Noahic period, right? Mm-hmm. Where community is basically, it's all tribes. There's not really, yeah. If you want to even call them that, it's just groups of people of like interests and like minds who gather together and for the goal of resource sharing and help with all that kind of stuff. Okay. So then you have, I'm going to skip around here a little bit because I don't think we want to spend too much time on this, but, and then you have when Israel was established as a people, it was very tribal,
yeah.
But tribal in a good way.
Yeah.
Okay. I need to make this point. I can't pronounce the Hebrew word that is actually in the Old Testament, katal, or Kahal, maybe, or Kahal. I can't remember how you pronounce that, but really that's in the Septuagint, that's translated into ecclesia. So the Greek ecclesia is what we really kind of look at, is what that all that's in the Septuagint is translated into. That's just some, you know, language stuff if you really want to. But anyway, that all that means is the assembly or assembly of people, or the called out could be another. So in biblical terms, that's what you see. Mm-hmm. When they're talking about community, that's what they're using. That's what word is most common. Okay.
Yeah.
So we see when Israel's really established as the people, this is their ecclesia. And what they're doing is secular influence isn't really embedded into this too much yet, but it's just all about their devotion to Yahweh. Mm-hmm. Right. And so there's just a group of people, they're just bound together by their belief in worship of Yahweh, right?
Yes.
So what does get, and they're very tribal at this point. I mean, I think I said that already, but, so in that period, the family was the basic, the extended family and extended family was basically a community at that point. Okay. And there was a patriarchal structure. Kinship patterns, were played into a big part of this. So they resisted any of the monarchy kind of structure.
Yeah.
So there was, I don't want to get really in the weeds here, but I guess the real thing is that in that tribal period, I think we have to look back at this period of when that was almost, that's better than when they started getting into the secularly influenced monarchy kingship type of scenario and really wanting to be a nation.
Yeah.
I think the people actually functioned more in unity before they let the secular influence. And I think you can see that throughout the biblical text in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Right? Now, not to say that, you know, like people like King Solomon or David or, you know, any of those people were bad necessarily, but I'm just saying, like, in, as far as a community goes, mm-hmm. there was more, you know, I can't really say that too much too. We're such a stupid people that screw up all the time, you know? So like, it doesn't really matter when you look at it. You're like, man, why'd y'all screw up so bad? And we do too. So,
yeah. Well, but I mean, okay. So where I'm coming from with this is, you know, I've said this before to you, Reggie, and I know that other people that know me have heard me say this, but I keep my circle small.
Yeah.
A lot of the reason for that is there's a dangerous element to there being too many moving parts that you can't keep track of in your circle. Right. And you also, I also am big on vetting character before I, connect to someone on a personal level. And if I can't vet your character, I'm probably not going to connect to you because I'm not willing to take the risk. But I think there's a kind of a of stages of this that have come over time. And if you look back in Acts, go to Acts chapter 4, I think it starts at verse 32. All the believers were united in heart and mind. This was after they had prayed and the Holy Spirit had moved over them, and that they owned was not their, what they owned was not their own. So they shared everything they had. The apostles testified powerfully to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and God's great blessing was upon them all. There were no needy people among them because those who owned land or houses would sell them and bring the money to the apostles to give to those in need. Part of that is my definition of community is, you know, as an example, if you were to reach out to me and say, Brian, I don't have any food. I'm not going to ask you if you want me to bring you food. I'm going to show up with food because you are in my community and you are in need. And I'm going to help you meet that need. Right. I remember as a kid, you know, although I'm very against what my grandparents' church was when I was a kid, because there was a lot of hypocrisy in that church. There was always a collection box for a family in need. And it was never, well, they came to us. They just knew each other well enough to know, well, Betsy's in need, so we need to get food and relief to Betsy, right? And help Betsy out and see what we can do for Betsy, which I think is being fought right now by this individualism that's being forced upon us, right? I mean, if you look at the media and you look at the world right now, they're telling you, you know, you're unique. You don't need anybody. Be your own this, be your own that. Don't depend on individual freedom. Woo. And that's really not what freedom is, right? It's really not what individualism is. If there's individualism within community, but usually that individualism within community is to help that community in a spot where they need that talent, right? The second thing I would say is, we currently have an issue in the church where we're killing the community, and I don't even think we know it. And here's what I mean by that. You know, Sister Martha and all them sitting on the front pew, and brother comes in a little red-eyed and hungover. Well, we haven't talked to that brother yet. We don't know what's going on with that brother. We don't know if that brother's got family issues, what's causing him to behave in the manner he's behaving in. But church should be a place where you can walk in and say, I drank myself to sleep last night because I'm struggling with something. I smoked myself to sleep last night because I was struggling with something. I slept with a woman, not because I wanted the sex, but because I wanted to feel safe. There's a problem in my life that I'm dealing with. And I feel like part of what the church is doing to kill community is the judgment coming through the door, right? Like, look, this is the place where they need to come and confess what's going on. And we need to wrap our arms around them and try to find a way to help them find a solution. And we've left that as a church. We've actually become a judgmental church. We've actually become a condemnational church in a lot of cases. And I know I pick on the Western church a lot, but I feel like we don't even realize that we're doing it, right? We don't even we're not even cognitively aware that that's what's happening. And the third leg of this is we're not carrying the community out here into the actual community. you know, I've run into a lot of what I like to call four wallism in church. We're going to take care of who's inside these four walls, but what's going on outside these four walls, we're going to just pray that nobody dies. And that's not community, right? You know, you and I had the idea to go out and just, you know, we're going to sell burgers, but the price of the burger is a question. You can ask us any question you want, right? Because we don't want to go out and take money from the community. We want to go out and be available to talk to people who are struggling and have conversations and stimulate the interaction between people that needs to be out there. So I think the problem we have is it's coming from all sides. It's coming from the world. It's coming from the church, and it's not being fought against in the community. The community is not fighting for itself. When I talk about tribalism in the Bible, yes, there were tribes, but they were all doing the same thing in the sense of we're going to church, we're worshiping, you know, Jesus is, you know, I mean, you look at the tribes that all, they all came from Abraham, right? So, but here, when I say tribalism, it is the very railing against of normalcy inside of a community.
So all that said, though, Brian, you got to pull back and go, what is community supposed to be? Because I think you point out a lot of problems with it that we have now, with the church and everything else, but I think you have to step back and go, okay, we have all these issues, but what is it supposed to be?
Well, I think the first answer to that question is there's a level of, there needs to be accountability amongst each other. We need to be held accountable. There needs to be a lack of fear to talk with one another when we're suffering an issue or we're having an issue. I call it the don't hurt. You can tell me this, but don't hurt my feelings, right? Like sometimes you need your feelings hurt, right? And that's not to say that somebody's being mean to you, but sometimes that's the change that happens when you get your feelings hurt. We live in this, I don't want to call it polite society because I don't really think it is. I mean, if you look at the condition of things now, it's not. But we live in this live and let live society, right? Like, you don't tell me what your problems are. I won't tell you what my problems are. You let me go believe that I can do whatever it is that I want to do as long as I feel like I can do it. And you go do you. And we just have this divide going on. And I think the first part of community is not necessarily giving up your individualism, because we're all individuals. We're all created uniquely by God. But it's realizing that the uniqueness that we were given was to serve the community.
Okay.
I think that's step one.
Okay. Where do we see an ideal community in the biblical text? We see one?
I don't think we see a perfect community, no.
Well, no, not perfect. I'm saying like at least we're...
I'd say the tribe of Abraham was about as close as I could see ideal. They fed each other. They clothed each other. They communed and they worshiped together. They supported each other.
I don't disagree with that. But I would say that I look at in Acts 2, really where the early church is being formed and going out and started doing stuff, as that starts to be where you establish true, I would call it like, you know, divine purposeful community.
Okay.
Okay. So because when you look at that, you see its main thing is missionary work.
Yeah.
And it's focused on that, like but also too, it's apostolic in that they're looking at, you know, the apostles are very much the leaders of the church, and they're going out. Not only are they doing it, but they're getting martyred at the same time.
Yeah, very true.
But it's extending that. Here's something, right? The early church was multiracial and experienced a unity across ethnic boundaries that was startling. So here we go. This is, and you got to understand how countercultural that was. That was unheard of in that period of time, like to have that kind of thing. It was a community of forgiveness and reconciliation.
Okay.
This is what they were really known for. Was famous. The early Christian church was famous for hospitality to the poor and to the suffering. Famous for it, right? That was huge. People, they were, Christians were known for this, okay? They were committed to the sanctity of life. They valued life tremendously. That was really what they were about. And it was completely sexually countercultural.
Yeah.
It was really, they took that all the way back, man and woman, that's it kind of thing. So what are some things that held them together? Well, for one, in the early church, they were bound and unified by a common truth, and that is of the gospel.
Yes.
Okay. That was all about Jesus, his teaching, his death, and his resurrection. They were uncommonly joyful, right? And you can see this in other writings about when they talk about Christians, how they describe those early Christians as uncommon. It's not really, they don't always use the descriptive of uncommon, but I mean, joyful, right? They were fearless and animated. They were not a passive body of people.
No.
Okay. And I think that's really huge, especially for now. I'll get into that in a minute. They were known for their love. So in other words, they really signify and they shown that they did love people. They gave sacrificially to the needy. And it wasn't the leaders of the church that really led anything. It was the laymen of the church that led these movements, right? They went out, they were the ones doing it. The leaders did not, they did, but like it was on the backs of the church body.
Yeah.
It wasn't the pastor going out writing books and teaching and doing all these, you know, preaching speeches and blah, blah, blah. Right. And they really had the mind of, they were the, put it like this, God's holy ambassadors in a dying world. Okay. So when we think about all of those different things, that completely counters what you're talking about as far as the problems in the modern Christian church.
Yes.
There's not a sense here in the early church of this materialistic, egomaniacal isolationism that is, but in rampant in the American culture anyway.
Yes.
So I think we got to do one thing here that's critical. I think we have to say that the culture that we are living in today has evolved to be more than what we see in the westernized modern church. Outside of the Western, it's even more so, where it's more isolated.
Yeah.
It's more fearful. It's more materialistic than we see even in the church. So like, what I would say is the cause of that is our American church is trying to connect to the culture but you're kind of letting that spin back and influencing your body too much from what's going on. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you fix this? That's just one aspect of this, but I'm just saying, how is a church, a body of Christians in America, I'm not talking anywhere else in the world, because there's parts of the world right now that their Christians are still persecuted, and they have gatherings in basements and
secret
stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in America, we don't have to worry about that. So, I mean, you know, so what I think for Brian, for what would be some ways we could influence or change, it depends on who we are, our churches to be more more outside the norm of isolationist, materialistic, egotistical bastards.
I'm going to say. Okay. All right. I'll take that. Okay. So the first thing I'm going to tell you, and this is something that I've really kind of centered on is, and this is going to sound controversial when I say it, but I'll explain it, is we need to stop praying for people and start getting to know people. And what I mean by that is, and don't get me wrong, if someone needs prayer and you want to pray for them, that's your right as a child of God to pray for somebody that needs prayer. But the thing that I would say in this that I find to be the problem is you work with me, Reggie. Let's use this as an example. Reggie works with me, and you can be around someone and tell when they're unhappy, something's going on. And one day out of nowhere, I walk out and I pat Reggie and I go, buddy, I'm going to pray for you. But yeah. I don't know Reggie's last name. I don't know necessarily what Reggie does at the company I work at. I don't know if Reggie's married, single. I don't know. We do this thing where we feel, where we think because we know who Christ is, that we can say we're going to pray for someone, and that is going to make sense to that person. Instead, maybe to start breaking this cycle, we ought to go, hey, Reggie, let's go lunch. Now, Reggie might not go to lunch with me. Reggie doesn't know me. He works with me. But I'm going to say, because I want an opportunity to get to know Reggie, right? Because by showing Reggie that I'm interested in who Reggie is, I'm more than just some, you know, and I've heard this before, well, you're just one of those prayer fanatics. You think you can just pray it all away. Well, it doesn't make sense to that person. So for me to walk up to them, I guess what I'm saying is, stop assuming that you know what to pray for someone and actually get to know that person and help them understand who you are, so that when you say, I'm going to pray for you, it makes sense, right? We have this thing where we feel like if we're saved, you know, we are children of God, we're brothers in Christ. Once we're saved, we're a son and daughter of the Lord. So we're brothers and sisters in Christ.
Yeah.
But if someone's not saved and doesn't understand what we are, a lot of what we say to them is meaningless because we haven't taken the opportunity to understand where that person's coming from. And I feel like the church uses that as a weapon to kind of be like, well, I don't really want to take the time to get to know this person, so I'm just going to tell them I'm going to pray for them. And you might drop a polite, Lord, help this person who needs some help. But you don't really know what you're praying for. Maybe that person needs to bend your ear. Maybe that person needs to talk to somebody. Right. And that kills community. Cause I remember back when I was a kid, you know, they just call them a whether the, when all the women get together, hens or something like that. My grandfather used to have a term for it. I don't know what it is, but those women would get together and talk to each other about their problems, and they would try to help each other. And there was no, honey, I'll just pray for you. It was, hey, Miss Betty, what's going on in your life? Tell me what's happening. Oh, that's terrible. What can we do to help you? Right? What can we do to help you? Not, you know, you look like you're struggling, I'll pray for you. We're all good, right? I think that's part of it. I think that's a good start, right? We need to get out into the community and learn what the community needs actually are.
Yeah. Yes. However, I would disagree, though. I'd say you must pray.
Well, I'm not saying prayer's bad, but I'm saying to the person you say that to,
okay,
it might not mean anything.
Okay. No, it may not. If you're praying, especially if you're praying for like some atheist dude you're talking to, which I do all the time.
Yeah.
They're not going to give any, they don't care. They absolutely do not care. And a matter of fact, probably be offended when you say that. But that doesn't negate the prayer.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's say I run into Timmy at the grocery store. And I don't know Timmy that well, but he's got some issues. He tells me about his issues and all this stuff. And I say, buddy, I'm gonna pray for you, man. But I don't do anything about it. Then yeah.
Yeah. But that's different, because that's different than what I'm saying. You took time to listen to Timmy's issues.
Well, this is where I'm going.
You know what I'm saying?
This is where I'm going.
Okay.
it's okay to pray. I mean, like, you should pray. The Bible says unceasingly pray. Okay. But we're not meant to be quiet observers of our families and our communities.
Yeah, for sure.
So unceasingly pray for everything. However, make sure you play a part in God's handiwork.
Yeah.
That's what you're on this earth for, to be obedient, and your worship through obedience is really what that means, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you may not know all this stuff about, because somebody, you know, here's the thing about people these days, and I'm the same way. I'm an old school guy. So like for me, showing weakness is like a no-no. Like you do not, I mean, like, you know, anybody but my wife is not going to know I'm sick. It's not, you know, hurt or whatever. It's just, there's only a few very close people who ever know any proud problem I have.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. And that's fine. But it wasn't always like that, and it won't always be like that. There could be a point in my life where I have something very, very, very serious, and I need a lot of things. And so, therefore, I have to suck up my pride and actually be a person that does reach out in the community of wherever that is and does say, hey, I need help.
Yeah.
So there's two things we got to deal with when we're talking about this particular scenario is – and I know what you're talking about too. Let me make that clear. If you're that guy who goes to church every Sunday, who's like you're the model church attendance person. You go to all the men's events and all that stuff. You go to the retreats, all that thing. But let's say that's your show of how Christian you are, but there's not one thing that you've done outside of church for anybody or any entity, like purposely, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. You're missing something.
You may pray for them too. This is what I mean. Like, cause remember the Bible, it speaks to this very, very well that we are to pray, but we're also to not just pray without action. Action follows the prayer. Mm. Or we reach out in faith to do something for someone else or for God or whatever. But we operate in faith praying about what we're doing, whether it's helping someone or another. It's not just sitting back and going, well, I'll pray. God's got it. Yeah. Now he does.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean because he's not looking, he's not a solo mission here. There's a reason why we don't just, God doesn't need us. He wants to share in his handiwork that he's doing. We are supposed to take part in this if we want, like we don't need to.
We don't have to.
We don't have to, but there is such a cool, uplifting, I don't know, energy, man, that you get when you start allowing to reach out, not just with your prayer, but actually getting out and doing something about it. And it's twofold. Don't be that guy who's capable, if you don't have money, use your time. If you don't have time, use your money. If you have both, use both.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest part about this is being sacrificial about your giving of your time, of your money. I know that in the early church, it's big stuff. We're talking like the people sell their entire estate and say, here you go.
It happened in Acts. It happened in the church of Ephesus. Now, it happened all over the place.
I'm not saying for someone to completely sell everything they have. And I mean, there's people that do that though. Granted, yeah. You have to be, there's wisdom involved in some of this stuff.
There is.
But if you don't give enough sometimes to where you don't feel it, that's not the sacrificial giving that the Bible talks about. If it doesn't hurt a little bit, you don't have to make a change for something and you're giving. That's not what the Bible's talking about. The Bible talks about someone is really in trouble. You skip out. You have to like take off of, you have to use vacation from your work in order to go help somebody.
Yeah.
They need, you know, $200 for their something critical, whatever. And you have $250. And it's your last $50, you know, that leaves you with $50 to spend for whatever. I'm just saying that's what sacrificial giving is all about.
Yeah.
So it is more than prayer. You have to make it more than just praying, though.
But do you agree with, and maybe it's just me, I might be alone on this, but this feeling that the church has abandoned responsibility with prayer. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, you know, there.
Oh, no, I think
church,
the church.
Any church that comes to me, any minister that comes to me, anyone that comes to me and says, you know, we can't find anyone that's in need, then you're not looking. There are plenty of folks out there in need. There are plenty of folks out there that are struggling to pay their bills, that are struggling to feed their families.
I have something to say about that, too. If you're not creating the atmosphere where the people who are that need something don't feel like they can come into your church, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. Like churches that are like, well, we're only open during church functions. The church should be open 24/7. You should be able to, you
know, I mean, yes and no. Like, you know, there's so many people who are trying to do bad stuff anymore that it's, I mean, I get it.
Well, but like one cool thing I saw one time, and this was, I think I saw it on an article I was reading is, there were two ministers at this small church, and they literally, when the church was locked, their cell phone number and their first and last name were on the door with it says, if you're in need of help, please call. So even if they weren't physically present inside the church, they were physically available for the ones who needed help.
Right.
But a lot of times, and I think it falls into this whole realm of, and this is another thing that I think is really a struggle, is it falls in this whole realm of, well, I'm only good at this form of ministry, so I'm only going to do this form of ministry. You know, and a lot of people blame that on the mega church, but as I've studied, I don't really blame that on the mega church. I blame that on the individual who limits themselves, right? If you're called to ministry, there is no portion of ministry. If you're called to lead, you're going to be at funerals. You're going to be at weddings, you're going to be at births, you're going to be at deaths, you're going to be at all these things. And there's nowhere in the Bible that says, just do the one you feel like you're good at, right? And I think that's part of it too, is we're sectioning people off. And I've talked about this experience before. Back when my wife first got married, we were going to a very large church, and we lost everything in a fire. And it was the first time, I believe, that looking back on it, that I ever had an utter spiritual crisis, because I was a newly married man, barely had anything anyway.
Right.
And we lost it all, like every bit of it. And I wanted to talk to the minister of the church we were attending. So I got my phone out and I called, and the secretary goes, oh, I'm sorry, he doesn't talk directly to people. Allow me to give you to one of the other 14 ministers that we have. I don't have a relationship with those ministers. I don't know those ministers. I need to talk to this gentleman who I have a level of comfort with to try to find a reason why this has happened. Now, let me also follow up with this, so everybody doesn't think it was a bad story. I've never seen a bigger outpouring of kindness than when we lost everything. My wife's mom and dad's Sunday school family essentially rebuilt us. Her grandparents sent us a check from Washington State so that we could buy new furniture and things like that. We were paying the bills and eating. That's what we were doing. And now that I had to replace everything, we weren't paying the bills and eating anymore, right? We were literally trying to figure out how to survive. And it was a very, but it was, you know, in that same frustration where I felt like, I also saw this outpouring of community these people who didn't know me. I'd never met most of them, but they heard what had happened and they immediately acted upon it, which is the flip side of what we should be doing. Like if you know that, you know, it's a shame. There's something that happened where in Greenville, where I'm from, and I asked a person about it and they were supposed to give me some information. And I never heard back from them. And I've sent them messages and I've never heard anything. But as soon as I heard it, I was like, man, we could probably help. So I sent a text. I said, get me information so that I can, and they never responded. And to me, it's a fail of our community in that situation. But you, do you think that that has anything to do with it? This sectioning off of ministry where I feel like it separates us even more.
Okay. Yes. But let me get back to this though. American churches, especially the mega ones, it's really complicated with where they help and how they help.
Yeah.
You still have a lot of scamming, a lot of people who...
You do.
It's not even... It's way more than you think, right? So it's not as easy as just going, here you go. Sure. Yeah. Let's help. But on the other hand, though, a lot of times the default is money.
Yeah.
Instead of service.
Yeah.
Okay. That's been my experience where I've gotten in some situations with me and the wife have where it wasn't money I needed. I didn't need money. I make it really well. I'm doing well for myself. I didn't need that. I needed help with people.
Yeah.
And that was... Oh, like, I mean, it was just so hard to have to for people to even show up or do anything, right?
Do you think that's because and this is going to sound crazy to say, do you think that's because we've kind of lost the know-how? We've gotten so used to answering the call with money that we've just kind of lost the...
I think this goes back to what Paul Harvey said. We've allowed ourselves to be too busy.
Yeah. Devil can't make you bad. He'll make you busy.
He'll make you busy.
Yeah.
We've allowed that.
Yeah.
Now, I intentionally I don't do that. Like I make sure I have lots of time. I do not make myself too busy. Now, I'll do stuff, but I am intentional in saying, no, I'm going to have most evenings where I don't have something going on. Cause I know I'm able-bodied. I know that I'm quite capable of helping with whoever needs it. And look, I've done it many times. But so this is what I'm saying. Like, you know, it's both. Where you have churches that do have people who give money. They have money, 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 money. Give. And then it's that outflow of that's bottlenecked.
Yeah.
Because of the way...
dishonest way, people, scamming, yeah, things like
but,
that.
But also, too, because it's just...
How do you propose that? What would you propose would be a feasible way of fixing that?
Okay, so here's the thing. What we just talked about with community.
Yeah.
Okay. You can't have the community so big where you don't interact with the people in it.
Yeah.
So there's one. And what I mean by that is the body of the church is not so big where you have problems with a secretary telling somebody, well, he doesn't do that.
Yeah.
Let me make this abundantly clear to anybody who's a pastor or whatever. If you are not shepherding your flock, you are not a pastor. Let me say that again. If you are not the shepherd of your flock, you are not a pastor. You cannot delegate all of those duties away. No. Does not work. That is not fulfilling your title as pastor.
Yeah.
Now, your primary role can be teaching pastor, can be
preaching,
whatever.
Yeah.
But if you're not going to, if you're not fulfilling and you don't do all the stuff that comes with it, if you don't talk to your people, or if your church is so big where you can't, There's no way you could talk to all your people. Your church is too big.
Yeah.
If you, because I mean, here's the thing. Here's what people have to understand. If you go to a church and it's you up on that pulpit every Sunday, and it's you're the ones who's speaking to them every Sunday, you're the one they want to talk to. They don't know the other elders, right?
Yeah.
Because this happens all the time. You have people, you know, that you go to a church and you have like all these elders. You don't ever, you know, you rarely hear from it's the guy up on the pulpit that's preaching. That's who's connecting to people. If your church is too big that you cannot speak to those as the preaching pastor, it's too big.
I'll go reverse of that. I also think that if you keep your church too small because you're afraid of opening yourself up to the community, then you're failing as well. Because I've been in churches where it's, well, we're, you know, the congregation isn't growing, right? And you'll ask the question, well, what is our outreach? How are we bringing people in? And they go, oh, we don't have any. We don't need any. We're just gonna preach inside these four walls, and we're gonna take our collection these 28 people that show up.
Yeah,
you're doing it wrong that way too.
Yeah,
right. Like there needs to be a balance.
Well, you know? and that's where
the community comes in.
Yeah, yeah. You can have. Let me say this. I think a mega church is possible and can fulfill community at the same time.
It can. Yes.
Okay. What I haven't seen is an implementation of that actually worked and was legit. And like I felt like this is awesome. Right. I have not seen that.
Well, I feel like what happens in larger churches oftentimes, and I'm not saying everyone, I've seen a few that are, I won't say they're perfect, but I like the way they run. And in the general sense, you see, one of the things I say is you give somebody enough power, it will always become too much power. And I see that in a lot of churches like Elevation, where, you know, there's a lot of things that minister has come out and said that are absolutely unbiblical,
to
150% heretical, if anything. But you know, I also think that we none of us are God, so a finite amount of power to us is almost always a corrupting influence. So you know, the only person I can say honestly that I really never saw that corrupting influence creep in on ever. That I actually watched. I mean, I haven't watched every church, so I can't speak for every church, but was Billy Graham. I never once saw or felt like the corrupting influence of these large, massive crowds that he preached to were corrupted.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know the man. I've heard many of his sermons. I thought he was a brilliant guy. And I mean, I could say the same thing. I mean, okay, let me speak this directly. Like Southeast Christian Church is probably one of the, I don't know, top five biggest churches in the U.S.
Yeah.
Right here in Louisville, Kentucky. And they're based in there. Huge church. And they do the mega church thing probably better than I've seen, but it's still missing some stuff.
Well, and honestly, and not to knock the church, but Julie and I went there and tried it. And it just was impossible to make any depth of connection.
Well, see, here's where I get even at their campuses. Okay. Yeah. You have thousands of people.
Yeah.
Well, how do you have community with 4,000 people come to a service? You know?
Yeah.
That's a lot. I mean, and how are you going to connect with, you might connect with like this little bitty thing, but then, so okay. I'll answer this question this way. If I had a church and I grew it to that many things,
yeah.
Okay. It would almost have to be like where I'm going to need pockets of like 50 people that form these communities inside this church that can get all connected. So you have an overarching community, but you have these little ones. Now they try to do that with small groups.
Yeah.
But I've never seen that small group thing like really take off that much. I think you really have to be like these 100. Okay, I got these 100 people. Here's a church. Here's a church. You have to really. I think the churches are just too big, and you got to divide it up even more.
Well, I think the satellite churches. I think the satellite churches were a little bit of an attempt to do that.
Well, they are, but I'm saying even at the Indiana campus,
they become overwhelmed as well.
Right. There's 4,000 people coming to that church on a weekend.
You know.
But no, now look, I must say this explicitly. Here's a disclaimer. I am not a church planting expert. I am not a experienced, you know, church builder guy. Yeah. So you could this is just what I feel like from going to, and both of us will say it, but going back to this though, we really have to say about our community. Now, church should absolutely be a part of this.
Yes.
But it's that living life together thing in a sacrificial, forgiving, gospel-centered way that is missing. We are in America, we are too wrapped up in our own nonsense to be able to live life together with other people.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not talking.
We're being taught daily not to.
Yeah, I mean, look. What was the one thing they did during the P word? Was they took people, and they said, "Hey, look, you can't do this. You can't do this. Shut in your homes. Blah blah blah. Isolate."
P word.
I know. I have to say that
it rhymes with shmamdemic.
I mean, and so that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, that's horrible.
Well, I think we still haven't seen the full the epitome of what that the damage that was done. So, okay, well, let me ask you this question. Do you think that the church in the general sense for community has just become lost?
No,
or do you think that we've just become fearful?
I think there's both, because I think it's not lost though, dude. You have some churches that are still really.
You do, yeah.
And in general, most churches are trying.
Yeah,
I don't think that it's like. Now we have a lot of churches. Okay, here's the thing about our neck of the woods: we have a lot of churches,
a lot of small churches.
Yeah, we have a lot of churches, right? This is part of the Bible Belt, bro.
Yeah,
you get outside of that though, the number of churches are wicked small. There's not near as many. It's culture shock if you've been that way and you moved to somewhere else. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But around here, with so many churches trying to do it, there's a lack of skilled pastoralship. Okay. Mm. I think that gift is really important.
Yes.
And I think maybe the people who should be pastors are not doing it because of whatever reasons, but man, you definitely see a lack. I would say you definitely see a lack of that leads to community problems.
Do you think that the percentage of people who are trying to take on a pastoral role that are not meant for it or incapable are somewhat responsible for the higher level of congregational breakdown that we're seeing and somewhat responsible for, because I mean, the levels of divorce and suicide are way higher amongst pastors now than they were 20, even 10 years ago. The amount of pastors that are quitting the ministry and leaving the church completely is elevating. Do you think that putting the wrong people in those roles is responsible for some of that?
Sure, that might be responsible for some of that. But I think a lot of times you have people who are just like, there's the pastor dies, and then you're like, who takes over? And then you're just like, well, I guess I'll do it.
Yeah.
Right? Or something.
Well, we'll get Elder Bob to do it. Well, yeah, Elder Bob may not want to do it.
Yeah. I think you have that scenario that happens, especially around here where there's like so many churches, you really don't have pastors just growing up and being like, okay, here, you've been groomed since you were 30 years old to be pastor. So here you go.
Well, and some of the best pastors I've ever met were never formally trained scholarly trained as a pastor.
Yeah. You don't need to be,
you know, some of the best I've known were guys that, dude, just broken men who found God and were filled up and wanted to let people know what salvation was. And they were on fire, and they would go out there and have 20, 30, 40 year long pastoral careers that were amazing.
Yeah. I mean, so yeah, part of that is that you, I mean, and I agree with you. the other part of the problem is that you're talking about, you're dealing with brokenness all day, every day.
Yeah. You're dealing okay. with heartache, heartbreak, and sin day in and day out.
It takes a special kind of person to be able to sit there and listen to the, you know, 37th spouse who's saying how they're cheating on their spouse kind of stuff. And the umpteenth murderer that you're going to see in prison.
Yeah, for real. Like legitimately.
Yeah. I mean, you know, just broken. That's all you're exposed to. You really have to be that guy who can, I mean, keep in mind, I think one of the biggest jobs of a pastor is to prepare themselves to be in that spiritual warfare space every single day. That means a constant prayer, constant thing about being in the Word. And that has to be like a not just a little bit. That has to be a, you know, a couple hours of the day you spend doing this stuff. Okay.
Yeah.
That has to be, I mean, cause you're going out and facing these things. Well, if you get to the point where, I mean, you're just broken down or whatever. I mean, it's just, you know, because I think everybody's going to have that. But if you're in, and if they slip in one way or another, like with their prayer or it gets out because they're too busy doing it, man, it's just a really, really tough gig, man. I mean, it's got to be tough. And and there's no way that, it's no one reason why you have this escalation, but you do. I mean, there's one thing is that the culture has moved to more depravity, you know? Yeah. So there's more of it that they're dealing with. So sure. But yeah, I mean, having the wrong person who just was the guy who stepped up to do it, but yet doesn't want to do it. I don't know. That's got to play a role in some of this, but I don't think all of it. I do think that we're not, here's what I would say is more of that is we're not lifting up disciples in our churches. We're not making them.
Well, that's true. Discipleship is dying inside the church.
Right.
I mean, it's really taking a brutal beating right now in the sense of, but I think this kind of circles back to the first thing I mentioned, which was part of discipling to someone is getting to know them so that you're speaking the right word into their life, right?
Yeah.
So that's a lot of the reason why I started with, you know, we got to stop just praying for everybody mm-hmm. and start praying and talking to people. You're right. Prayers should always be a thing, but, you know, get to know somebody, talk to somebody, get to know who they are, right? You want to disciple to somebody and speak Christ into their life. The most influential people in my sphere are people that took the time to get to know me as an individual and then attempted to speak into my life because they carry more weight.
Don't discount the power of the greeter at the church.
Yeah.
For one, but don't let that be the only person that talks to someone.
Yeah.
At your service.
Well, our current church that we're going to right now, I find that to be, you know, we are constantly approached by members of the church to shake our hands and ask our names. And it's been a long time since I've been in that open an environment of connection, right? Which is one of the things that draws me to where I'm going now.
We went to a church, Brian. We went to an event for people. They had like a pizza dinner thing, something. Yeah. I can't remember. Which the lead pastor couldn't be there mm-hmm. for some stupid thing that he was doing. And we got to speak to one of the other elders who didn't have a lot of answers to what I had because I was asking very theological, technical questions.
Yeah.
And then at the services, so I went to three services and I never had anybody say a word to me. And I said, no, we're not doing this.
Well, you know.
Now, look, I'm an intimidating fellow. Now, look,
you're not intimidating.
Well, I mean, if I go into a place, I'm in a church, I'm.
Let me take that back. I know you, Reggie, so you're not intimidated.
I know, but like so. I know I'm looked at in that way. And it's not like I'm saying I'm this tough guy or whatever. That's not it at all. No, but I mean I don't want to get into that, but yeah, I mean so I said no, we're not doing that. We're not going to a church that doesn't have the body does not, it goes back to the early church. The layman of the church led the movement.
Well, and here's the thing. One of the things I encourage people to do too is, you know, if your church is not feeding you, find the one that will.
Or find the one where you can be a part of what they do.
But I mean, if you need to be fed, that's the one thing. And more often than not, when I find that there's someone who is a long-term person in the church and they're stumbling, is they've become the lean-to for everyone.
Yeah, but also too,
and they don't have a lean-to.
I think I've reached this point every so often. You get to a place where you're just like, oh, you've read the Bible 17 times, you know, through all the way through, and you've studied scriptures and all that stuff. And man, you just needed a break. And then you get to this break point. And you're just like, and then it's in that point in time when, you know, you start to slide a little bit because you're not in the word.
Yeah.
And that's the problem.
Yeah.
You know, so you can't, as mature Christian as anybody is, don't let that keep you away from being in the word.
Well, but something else I would say too is, it's okay to, if you become friends with the pastor of a church, it's okay to ask them to go grab lunch and not talk about the church, right? It's okay to go and sit down with someone who's a leadership in the church and just say, hey man, how are you? How are you doing as an individual? Well, what's going on with you?
I will not. So here's my thing. I will not be a part of a church unless I can go have lunch or coffee with the pastor.
Yeah.
I won't do it. Because I mean, again, this is supposedly going to be the leader of your community.
Yeah, this is the head of the community.
And if you cannot sit down and talk to that person, look, I've had it where it was like 3 months. Oh well, we can come see you in a couple. You know, how about in, you know, it'd be like two, it'd be like a month and a half away.
Yeah,
that don't work either.
Yeah, you're way too covered up if that's the case. Right. Yeah. Like I'm, you know, what this really kind of boils down to for me is, you know, I think people miss the opportunity of community when they begin to, put the self over the collective and, you know, if tribalism meant the same thing that it meant back in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, I don't think I'd have a problem with tribalism.
No.
But I don't think it means the same thing today.
Well, no.
I think that tribalism today is probably the antithesis and the sworn enemy of community at this point, right? Because I'm so, you know, and another thing, and let me put this out there.
Excuse me.
Friendship, you know, that word is, you know, my wife will tell you this, the word friendship means something to me. If you are my friend, that means a whole lot for me. That means that I know you well enough to have vetted your character, that we have enough commonalities where I want to pour into you and I want you to kind of influence me. I see a mirror of myself within you and we are going to be able to do, you and I have been friends for a long time, Reggie. Mm-hmm. I don't see friendship as my Facebook list, right? I don't see friendship as an influencer thing. I don't see friendship as a, you know, well, I've got 25 friends at work. No, I don't. No. I don't want 25 friends because if I give you that station in my existence, that means that you mean something to me and that if I fail you in some way, I'm going to take that hard and do all I can to never do that again. And then I'm always going to try in the best way I know how to succeed. So I think community's kind of gotten lost in this just whitewashed definition of friendship.
Well, but here's the thing. I don't disagree with you, but we, the laymen of the church.
Yeah.
It needs to start there. Now, leadership. Look, leadership can try to do stuff, but I'm saying it does no good if the leader's the only one talking about it and doing anything about it.
Yeah, for sure.
So in other words, if you're a Christian, cross-back, Bible-beaten, you know, Jesus freak kind of Christian.
Yeah.
Cool. Then take it upon yourself to start being in an active member of your community.
Yeah.
You know, if, and that's, I think that's really where it's going to have to go.
Well, I'll admit my fault. Like when Julie and I started going to this church, we were going to service. So the kids would go to the kids groups and we'd go to service and then we would leave. Well, we weren't getting any community. So we started prioritizing the Sunday school classes, which have actually turned out to be really good.
Yeah.
And in that I've started to feel a stronger sense of community. People know my name. They, when they see me, they greet me, they talk to me, they know who I am when I come in. So I think there's a very large, I don't want to say overemphasis because I don't believe that hearing, I don't believe that God's, the seed of God's word is ever spread without some sort of benefit.
Sure.
But that's why I really struggle in the sense where I say, you know, teaching to the individual is just as important as teaching to the congregation. So when you look at, you know, a congregation where they don't have small groups and all they have is Sunday service, you're not going to have a great community there because they're not, there's nowhere to go to deepen your understanding and to grow closer to others.
See,
and to build.
Yeah. You know, but I would say though, too, like if you can create a body where you don't need a small group because everyone's doing it organically, that's where it should go.
Yeah, but does that build community though?
Yeah. Like, so this is what I'm saying. Like, if you're influencing and you're saying that this body is the, these people are who you're going to live life with. You know, you're all like-minded believers. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you go out and you're like having dinner, helping, going to their birthday parties and, you know, celebrating holidays and all that stuff together. You're organically being in that, you've just brought community together. You may not have one single small group, but if your body is actually doing life together, you're doing it. Now you could have a group of people who say, well, you know what, man, we want to go farther than that sermon you were teaching.
Yeah.
Well, here's a Wednesday night deeper dive into whatever it is. That's how I would probably do it. Right.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of what a lot of smaller churches are doing is they'll have a Sunday school class and then they'll have a Wednesday night Bible study and then they'll have a lady study and a men's study. But I feel like I always get a little bit more from those individualized experiences. And don't get me wrong. I think a sermon is great, especially an uplifting sermon but I also am a big advocate of the churches tragically misusing or underusing the testimony. You know, I've always believed that by hearing the testimony of someone in my community who has overcome something always gives me strength going out into the world. And I feel like we have become such a church of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, you know, Acts, Ephesians, we're going to teach you Judges. We're going to teach you. And every once in a while, occasionally we'll sprinkle in a testimony here and there. I feel like if you really want to impact people, especially people who are coming into the church searching, if I would have walked into a church at the age of 20 and you start hitting me with the book of Mark, I probably would have been like, yeah, I don't know what that is. But yeah. I remember the very first time I heard a strong testimony. And when I say a strong testimony, I said a moving testimony.
Yeah.
You could have shot me out of a cannon. Right. When we heard the guy from 13 Hours, I was so excited to hear that man's spiritual part of that story and how strong it made him during what had to be the most frighteningly heightened, horrifying experience on the planet. But so back to community. Give me, if you had an ideal or could see an ideal community, Reggie, what would it be? Like if you thought that if there could be an ideal community, what would it be?
Hey, I'll tell you what, the Catholics got close.
They're very, you know what, I'm going to be honest with you, and I'm going to make a confession, speaking of Catholics. I've railed on Catholics a lot, mainly because of misunderstanding. But the more I study the Catholic Church, the more I begin to understand that, yeah, there's a lot of things that they say that I disagree with. But when it comes to living life together, they got that down.
This is what I'm saying. Like, they made it a point, and yeah, I mean, look, there's aspects of the Catholic Church. I'm not going to say Catholic faith. I'll say the Catholic Church.
Yeah, this has nothing to do with faith.
No, the organization as the Catholic Church, let's say that I completely and totally find to be borderline heretical in how they view things. Okay. Yeah. But when they would come into some place, and this was back when they were expanding the Catholic Church a lot.
Yeah.
They'd build a school, or they build a church, they build a school, they build a hospital, right? I mean, you can't get any more centered around community than that. Right there. You're educating, you're healing people, and you're giving everybody what God says, right? Yeah. I mean, there's no better sense of community. Now, what's really silly, if you think about it, is that most of our hospitals, these big mega hospital things started without like that.
Yeah.
As a Christian or Catholic organization that were trying to do something. Especially all the ones around here, they all started that way. They all have this plaque in their hospitals telling about how they started with this mission of blah, blah, blah. And how far have they freaking fallen?
How the mighty have fallen.
But yeah, I would say, so your ideal community, if you want to think about it, it's an open, let me say that, open community where it's not just, walled up around and, you got this entry and everything into it. Well, at least currently could get to that point, but I mean, where it's just people that live and they they're around each other all the time. You know, it's almost like that old school, like what you see in the movies, the medieval villages and stuff where everybody's like, hi, how you doing? Let's go get some bread from Bob. And yeah, we'll go get, Nancy's flowers over here and blah, blah, blah. You just have a community of people like that. And then the church is at the center. And that's where they go. That's where everybody, that's the community spot for, they have their meals. They have community meals there. They have outreach there. They have their teaching times there. I mean, that's the center of everything. That's what community should be.
Yeah.
Now, is it possible to do that in 2024? Yes.
Absolutely.
But it would take people in a geographic location to decide that's what they wanted to do.
Yeah.
That also entails bringing back small town America, because we've had small town America disappear.
Yeah. Although you and I live in a pretty close facsimile of small town America.
Right. But we don't have we've run mom and pop businesses out in favor of them. Big box stuff. Right. I'm talking about community is back to not only are we lifting up people and their health and their wellness and their sense of,
but we're supporting local business.
Yes, we're raising up our own business people to serve the community we're in.
Do you think that is do you think that's possible for us to do now in that sense? Well,
I think it's possible, but this has to be a mass cultural change, right?
Do you feel like it's possible for that cultural change to occur?
Yeah, we just ought to be Amish.
I don't know. I got issues with the Amish too.
Well, so. Yeah, but you go to these Amish communities, dude. Communities. That's they are what they
for
are.
Sure. They are for sure tight knit.
Oh yeah, like, they're a whole circle of people. If a barn burns down,
they all come to help rebuild it.
And they all build the dang gone barn back up. Yeah. Right. If someone has a problem or whatever,
and they do not, but the way they've protected their communities is they do not respond well to interlopers.
Oh no.
Like, and I think that's the part of community that they failed in is well, we just don't, if you're not born and bred Amish, we don't really want you here.
Yeah. Now the Amish community up here a little bit, they're pretty cool
people. Yeah. But I've been around some Amish folks that won't even talk to you.
Even up there, they won't. Yeah. They're not really, they don't look at you like you're from Mars kind of. Yeah. Like. But anyway, yeah. I mean, that's what I would say, man. It's like you'd really have to go, you have to go back to the early church after the Pentecost. And you have to look at that and go, how are they doing church then? And not that we have to emulate that exactly, because we're not being persecuted like that. It is still missionary focused, but
we're not getting flogged.
Well, no, but we're not. But you know, generally people know Christianity.
Yeah.
They know it exists. They don't necessarily know what it means. But so I say like, but just getting back to how we are known, like if they back then could be known for uncommon joy, for their sacrificial giving, for their love of people and stuff, man, that's what we should really be striving for. Yeah. Now that does not mean, and I think this goes back to when they say they're not a passive church, like that doesn't mean you accept everything and let everything, oh, cool, we love you. Well, yeah, you love everybody, but that doesn't mean you like praise and worship unbiblical attitudes and lifestyles. I'll say that.
Yeah.
Now, it means you work with those people and you don't shun them or whatever, but it
doesn't. Yeah, that's.
Okay. So anyway, yeah. We can get to a point where we have better community within our churches. I just think we need our laymen to really be more educated and more understanding about what that is. And they actually have to put actions behind it.
Do you think that ministers and leadership inside of churches should be pushing a requirement for the membership to be out? Do you think that should be something that they are? Because I find that a lot of ministers shy away from that because they don't want to upset their congregation. But I mean, I don't know that I've been in a lot of sermons where the minister has directly challenged the congregation on that very thing, right? I find that a lot of sermons nowadays are very polite, right?
Well, I mean, I think you challenge people to do something, but like it can't be a criteria to where you say, hey, if you're not doing this, it's such and such, right?
Well, but I mean, challenge them in a way where you're calling it to the table, right? Like... Like, you know, one of the things that I've always, you know, admired about the Bible is the underlying, I'll say, or the undercurrent of the Bible is sacrifice. And it's very in your face. It's an undercurrent, but Abraham, you know, all of the things that went on in the Bible, the underlying was the sacrifice, right? Sacrifice for community, sacrifice for God, sacrifice for your fellow man, all those things. But I don't hear a lot of challenging sermons where we're pushing people to get out of their comfort zone. Does that make sense?
I mean, I have.
I've heard some. But I'll be honest with you, most of them are coming from people like Vadi and MacArthur and all these guys that are, they're known for being very, very direct with their message.
Well,
but in the smaller, less known church, I feel like there is a little bit of an undercurrent of, I'm going to tell you what you should do, but I'm not going to press you on it because I don't want to upset my congregation.
I think you have congregations that are struggling so much sometimes where it's like the pastor feels the burden of like, how's he going to keep the lights on? You know, with, and I think that probably plays into some of the light touch kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I know that Kyle Edelman hasn't strayed away from that.
Yeah.
I mean, he's definitely very direct. He's very direct. And he does challenge people a lot. Dave Stone used to do the same
Dave
thing.
Dave Stone.
You know, I've heard many other guys. I know some of the guys we've hung out with, who are more charismatic. I know they do sometimes.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think that's really a problem necessarily. I just think we gotta grow disciples. for one.
Yeah.
And we got, while we're raising up disciples, we got to encourage everyone to be in community with each other and to be more sacrificial what we have, but also guard your time. I think that's really the biggest thing in America right now is like, it's a struggle because we live in such a high dollar culture where, you know, things aren't cheap. Just to live in a regular old house is not cheap.
Yeah. Owning a home is not a cheap thing.
No, I mean, so you know,
owning a car is not cheap.
And it's like, that means there's a lot of peace. You know, I hate that whole thing where there's so many other places in the world where you're so much wealthier than that, but that's not applicable to where we live. You got to understand that. Like yes, I could actually sell everything I got and move to like a third world country and live the rest of my life with whatever I have. But is that what I should do? Is that my place? Am I going to influence or do anything in a third world country where, you know, it's probably a hell of a lot more dangerous and all this stuff for my kids and everything else? Is that really where I should go? No. We live in this culture. That's not how it works here. Anyway, that just always rubs me the wrong way when I hear this nonsense.
I'm going to move to Namibia.
No, but there was I still want to get a group of people together and move into there's a village in Tuscany that's $1 million bucks.
A
whole daggone village, bro. You can buy for $1 million in Italy, in Tuscany, Italy, right? What I think it's Tuscany. I can't remember, but it's in Italy, right? So imagine that you get a group of people and you say, well, look, here's our community. We have a whole village to populate and do something with.
Yeah.
Poof.
Poofy. We have a community.
Bam.
To be mixed up with the show Community, which is funny, but a little bit inappropriate. So, Well, maybe we should pose that as a question to the people out there that are listening to this and see if we can get any responses. What are your guys' idea of a community? We'd love to hear from you. I'd like to hear your queries on what community could be.
Okay. I have other things.
He has other things.
All right. Have you had one of those, not near death experiences necessarily, but like been in a situation where you really thought this is it. I'm going to bite the dust.
Yeah. About 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Like you seriously were like, yep, this is it. I'm going home.
Yeah. I was checking the boxes in this situation. I was driving home from work. It's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'm driving along, doing about 40 miles an hour. Wasn't going really fast. Speed limit's 45. And the road I was driving on, tree limbs lined to both sides. And out of nowhere, dude, this deer comes out of the tree line. So I hit the brakes, but it starts to fishtail because it's a little wet. The roads are a little wet. It's been raining. I slide and my wheels straddle the side of the road. So my car is dragging. And as I'm getting up the road, there's one of those driveways that has the pipe underneath it. So my thought is, I can't get my car to bounce back out. I'm like, and I don't have enough road to brake before something bad happens. So I'm literally asking myself, I was like, this is how I'm going to go. Like, and I reach over as far as I can on the wheel. I jerk really hard. I snap up on the road. But when I hit the road, I start to hydroplane. So I'm like, well, crap, now I'm out of the ditch. Now I'm going to die. Well, finally, I turn into the hydroplane. I get the car. I'm sideways across both lanes. I don't think my heart has ever beat that hard. Like it was coming out of my chest. And I had to sit there. I was like, I don't care if anybody hits me or not. I can't move. And I'm sitting there and I'm my ears ringing. But during that experience, I'm like, this is how it's going to happen. I'm going to eat it right now. Like I'm at 40 miles an hour, I'm going to hit this embutment and I'm done.
Now, when you're at that point, I think this is telling. If you're at that point and you're freaking out or you like really, really get anxious or fearful, you're doing wrong. You got to change your life.
Why do you say that?
Because I think if you're right, if you're doing stuff right and you got yourself right with, you know, and you're living by the gospel, I don't think you would feel that moment at all.
I don't know that I feared the moment. I don't know that I feared the pain.
But see, I think
you're feared losing
adrenaline and anxiety to do what you're. That's not what I'm talking about. Like that dread of I'm going to die. Oh no.
Well, I didn't have that moment. I just said to myself, yeah, I'm gonna bite it right here.
Okay.
Like I'm just gonna bite it.
I had this moment where I thought this is it. I'm gonna die. No way around it. I thought that. It was a long time ago. But I was in a two-wheel drive truck on the snow and on the interstate and I lost it. And I kept spinning and spinning and I hit the guardrail, bounced back like this. And a semi truck comes and another car come up, hit me in the back. So when I'm spinning and I hit that guardrail, I thought, I knew there was cars behind me. I was like, I'm done. I'm done. Dead. I'm
finished.
Done. I'm dying. There's no way around it. I'm traveling 60 miles an hour. Truck's going nuts. Car's behind me. He's going to slam me. There's a semi not that far back. I'm toast. There's no way. And what I thought, and I was thinking about this the other day, like, I thought, well, I really didn't look at it like, oh crap. I'm going to die. It was just like, all right,
here we go.
It was just totally like it. And I thought, well, is that really how we should, is that an illustration of what we should feel like as a person of faith?
I don't know that that's necessarily a fair depiction.
That's what I'm asking.
That like if you're calm and all of a sudden everything on planet Earth starts to go wrong and you're physically out of control of it, I think there's a sense of panic that's just natural. There's just
your adrenaline. I didn't panic at all.
Your adrenaline's going to kick in. You're going to start to breathe a little harder. Things are going to get a little more intense. I don't think that's necessarily wrong living. I think that's just kind of a natural animalist. It's no different than if you trap a wild animal.
But I'm saying, like, if you say this is it, this is my end.
I said I was going to bite. I knew I had for a split second decided I'm going to bite it.
Yeah, like, but it wasn't like I'm going to bite it. Oh no, if I die, that's it. That's the end, kind of thing. Right.
Yeah, no,
that fear of that right there is what I'm talking about.
It's harder for me, and I'll tell you why. I was not the wisest human being in my teenage years, and I had a very big tendency to go towards the risky and the violent. So I've been in a lot of situations where probably should have bit it. So fear of death weirdly has never, it's never really been a thing for me. Now that's not a faith thing. But I think I just kind of faced it so many times that I just kind of was like, eh, you know.
Okay.
But like,
I was just curious. I was thinking about it, man.
I would say you should always. I think you should always have a sense of calm about now. Okay, so I'll preface it with this: I've had this conversation with my father many times about this thing where he just pines for death because he wants to see the Lord. I don't think that's right.
Yeah, my dad said the same thing, man.
I don't think that's right. Nah. I think, you know, if you truly believe that heaven is your destination and you truly believe that you've lived a life that's worthy of it and you know that God's in control, you know, it's funny, in my Sunday school class, there was kind of a conversation today when it talks about it in Ephesians where, you know, when Christ died for your sins, you were stamped his, you know, which goes back to the old, you know, once saved, always saved conversation,
right.
Which you and I have talked about. Once you're saved, you're always saved.
That's it.
You know, I believe that once you commit that and you confess your life to Christ and you know that you believe in him, fear of death is really an irrational fear. It really is. It's just an irrational thing to be afraid of.
Yeah. All right. So here's another one, right?
Okay.
We had a couple comments about the CTMU video.
Okay. Lay it on me.
And it's what, and especially, here's what I will say. We even said this, and I think some people just don't even watch the video. They just comment on, they see the title of the video and comment.
Yeah.
We said that as theories go, it's not your typical theory from the scientific or academic community. It's totally written in a different way. It's got a lot of really hard, it's really hard to read. And
yeah, it's not an easy thing to go through.
No, it's, and so from an academic perspective, no, it's not a very, very, if you're basing it on academia,
yeah.
No, it doesn't qualify in academia. And I don't think that's debatable.
I don't think he meant it to have no. academic relevance.
But I think it's really, really silly and really ignorant if you discount that type of, how would I put this, thought, because it doesn't meet academic theoretic confines.
Well, I think here's my problem with academia is, you know, something like the CTMU, I can, through my own faith and the history of my faith, I can find some relevance in it. Not all of it. Not all
of it. We talked about a lot of things that we did. We thought
were hokey,
yeah.
But there are some relevance. But it's like theoretical physics. Well, that's a theory. There's no real evidence that they can give me. And that's where I run into problems with a lot of the science-based stuff that gets thrown at us is theories are great, but, you know, the theory of evolution, it's a theory.
But theories are, okay, you know, there's a formula for a theory and why they call them a theory, and they have particular structure to them. Yes, I understand that. But what I want to make a point, though, is if Langdon is as smart as he is.
Which I believe he is.
I mean, obviously he's intelligent, so I don't think that's debatable.
Yeah.
But if he is as smart as you, why, then no, you're not. He's not going to be understood by the current academic environment.
Someone with that high of an IQ and that big of a level of intelligence is going to have a hard time being understood by anyone.
Well, I know. Now, there's a lot of things, there's a lot of pushback for, by the way. Lots of it. I don't blame people because, I mean, it's proper to probably be a little skeptical, especially in a scientific
arena. Well, you should always be questioning it in science,
yeah,
right?
And I think part of Langdon's issue here is that, you know, there's other guys who have had that, like, you know, Da Vinci and Aristotle and, you know, some of the other big who did all these things, you know.
Well, he's not the first person to dip his toe into that particular pool, right?
But I'm saying, like, you know, so when the argument is, well, all these people did all this stuff and you see that, and what's he really done?
Yeah.
But I don't think you can discount a theory of everything and like a equating like a language model for the universe. Like, I think that's something. Like, I think that's not just nothing. I think that's a lot, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just think it's a little silly to, like, well, because his theory is really theory, it's not falsifiable, and all this nonsense. And by the way, Professor, if somebody says Professor Dave, Professor Dave's a literal hack job, so I don't really want to hear anything about that. That's just dumb. And no, I'm not going to give you all the references because I don't watch him, because I've already tried and it was dumb.
Yeah, he's a little bit rough for me.
No. Anyway, so the other thing.
Okay.
I know we're running a little long here, but
it's okay.
And I especially was thinking about this with Community, because we've talked about men and that whole being capable of being a monster.
Yeah.
So I was watching the show The Old Man.
Okay.
And he's a old ex-CIA spook person kind of guy. He kills people and blah, blah, blah. Right?
Yeah.
And his daughter gets kidnapped or whatever, and he doesn't really care what he does. He's trying to – he becomes a complete monster in order to, like –
to get her back.
Even if even this one guy who, spoiler alert, this one guy who may have information for, about where his daughter is, doesn't matter how slim it is, he's going to do whatever he has to do to this guy to get him to spill the beans, right?
Yeah.
So he's completely not, that's a really barbaric state of mind to get into, but he's doing it for, even if there's a slightest chance he can get some information to her. And I was it brought me to think, we should be capable of violence in order to protect those we love and contain that violence in order to even equate to being good. But where does it stop, though? Because I was thinking about this with my, I truly don't think I would, I don't know what I would do in that scenario, right? Because for one, I'm not trained in that, but I don't know if I would even care. You know what I'm saying?
This is hard. Again, this was a difficult one for me because for a long time, there was a part of me that was completely out of control with that. So, but what I would say is this. There is a very animalistic, feral part of men that exists, even in the weakest man, if he's pushed far enough, right?
Well, they'll run, though. They won't.
They will.
They won't stand up.
Actually, you know, in a lot of cases, if you push a person hard enough, long enough, they get tired of running, even if it means pain for themselves. But what I would say to you is this, for me, it depends on the scenario. If I see an innocent bystander being hurt and I can intervene and stop that, I will. Does that necessarily mean I will revert to violence to do it? No, not necessarily. The more depends on the situation. I will not tolerate a man putting his hands on a woman. Zero, period. Exclamation point. And I will teach a very physical lesson to get my point across if I ever see a man cross that line.
But we're,
I believe that there's a certain level of cowardice in men that is just unacceptable.
Well, yeah, there's definitely
but that. When it comes to my family, I'll burn everything down to ashes and do it again.
That's what I'm saying.
And I'll never bat an eye.
Because I really thought, well, I wouldn't. And I don't know if I feel good about this or not, but I mean, like, I truly think that I would do the same thing. I don't care how remote of a possibility it is that this person has information about where my kid is.
If there is a 1/100th of a percent chance that my family's in danger and you have information that can help me get them away from danger, I will do what I have to do.
Right. And I think that's where I'm at. I was like,
but here's the thing too. I don't think it's bad or good. I don't feel I need to reconcile it on either side. It is who I am. It is the nature that I was built, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I think I think here's what I'm saying is, as violent as that, or as much as we're talking about here, I do think it can go too far. I think if you're talking about like torture or something, I think it's too far, dude.
Well, I'm not torturing anybody, right? That's too much time.
Well, that's what they were doing in the show, right?
Yeah, I know, but that's also the CIA and the FBI and all
no,
that
he's
stuff.
No, he's not really in those.
Former CIA or whatever it is. Yeah. But for me, I'm finding the quickest avenue to the information I need, right? Like, I don't have time to stand around and beat on somebody and waterboard them and put them in an uncomfortable position and zip tie their hand. I don't have time for all that. We're going to get there as quickly as we can possibly get there with all means necessary.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think physicality is going to be involved.
But I think one of the things, what I mean by that when I say I don't really feel one way or the other is, I don't think we need to. I don't think I need to explain to anybody the level of importance that my children and my wife hold to me. And because of that, anything that I do to protect them should be expected.
Yeah.
Right. Like if you're menacing my wife and you don't expect something from me, then you're a fool.
Yeah. I mean, I guess where it struck me as how far that went.
Now, granted, though I have a real problem with torture and, you know, like,
even, but I don't know if this is what I'm saying, man. I don't know if I wouldn't. Is what I'm saying.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you wouldn't either. I mean, well, that would also depend on the situation. I mean, if the direct route ain't getting you there, maybe you got to start pulling out toenails and
I don't know.
You know,
I'm just saying like
crazy stuff, but
I just know that I don't think I would be human at that point.
I don't think any of us would.
Yeah. I mean, I think if my little girl,
I think you're fully feral.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I mean. I'm going back to your term. I think I'm a complete raging beast at that moment.
Yeah.
And I do not care.
I mean, if something happened to one of my boys and I knew that your intent was to harm them.
Yeah.
There's nothing human left in me at that point.
That's what I'm saying. Like, and that struck me though, as like, yeah, I don't know, a little bit of like, ooh, that hits home a little
bit. It's hard to think about.
Yeah. Because I mean, like, if you think about you think you could do that kind of thing, right? Which I think is a really, I mean, you're talking about monstrous type of stuff.
Yeah, that's a level beyond.
And I'm like, that kind of makes me feel a little, not I shouldn't say uncomfortable, but like really, you know, like, ew. Cringe a little bit, right?
It does.
And I mean, and it was just, but I think that's, and I don't, that's not necessarily what I would just say is there's this, that's not a characteristic of being a good or bad man necessarily, but it is like, I don't know. I think it really would, that would test your humanity and your faith if you got into a situation like that, man. I just,
of course.
Woo.
But I also think that that's, you know, hope for the best, prepare for the worst, right? Like, I mean, I'm, you know, I also think that'll change with age. You know, I think as we're younger, we're more capable of more uncontrolled action. But I think as we get older, you know, we may be feral, but we also are much more pointed at what we're trying to do, right? Where when, yeah, when we're young, it's kind of, you know,
well,
and nuclear and fallout and, you know, collateral damage. But when we're older, it's,
I mean, especially if you're like, you know, you're not, let's say you're a senior citizen type of age, right?
Yeah.
So you've already lived most of your life. You already done that. There's really not, if you're getting a scenario where your kid's in trouble, even at that, you know, even at if they're level, an adult.
Yeah.
I mean, you're probably, you don't care.
Yeah. At that point, you've lived most of your life anyway.
Yeah. You're just like, I don't care. I'm just, you know.
Yeah. I'm just tearing through it.
You know.
Right. You know, yeah, I mean,
anyway.
It's a very hard thing to think about.
No, I mean, it's, just, I just found it to be like, it was like one of those like, whoo.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could stop myself from not doing something as horrendous as what was going on. And, I don't know. That just made me think a lot about that, bro. I mean, like, you know, defending your family from an actual attack is one thing.
Yeah.
But like trying, like going after somebody who may or may not have information about this that was like a third party type of thing. And yeah. I'm thinking, I don't know. But anyway, well, that's all for today.
Yeah.
Folks. I don't know what we're going to talk. I don't think we got our topics straightened out. We have a couple ideas. So
yeah.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned, guys. And like, let us know what you think of the new set format. Let us talk to us. Tell us about this. I'll Vanna White it for you.
Anyway.
There you go. But anyway, thanks for listening today, guys. I'm Brian.
I'm Reggie.
This is R&B Talks. See ya.
Bye-bye.